Welcome to Finding Proof, where we discuss all things early stage VC.
We're your hosts, Thanasis and Jenny of the Proof Fund, and our goal is to get to know the best seed and early stage VCs out there. Today, we're speaking with David Kremen, who is the founder and managing partner of Frontier. He currently invests across the U.S. in seed and early stage businesses with a thematic approach. David, thank you so much for joining us today. We're obviously really looking forward to the conversation. I'm personally most excited for the special performance at the end of this that you have not agreed to yet, which is this. Yeah, I did that. I'll stop it.
David is shaking his head. For those
for context, David is a former recording artist, and I'm just kidding about the performance, although he could surprise us. So I know you go way back with Thanasis and our other partner, John Backus, but I'd love to hear about your background and how you got into VC.
Yeah, it was circuitous. And as I talk to young people about their careers, I think my path is an example of how to be unorthodox and follow your passions. I got an engineering degree from Stanford. That's actually where I met John Backus. My passion was music. So I turned down the big job offer from then consulting firm Arthur Andersen, and I went into music. Not everyone thought that was a good decision, but that was my startup, basically. And I performed and I worked with two or three different startups, meaning bands. And after a while, worked my way up into what could be thought of as a funded company. We were signed to Atlantic Records, toured and toured.
What was that like? By the way, the cover is pretty badass. I obviously had to do some DD here before this conversation. And I'm not going to lie, you were a trendsetter with the ripped jeans and the knees, because that's the thing these days.
Hopefully I'm still a trendsetter, because that's what would be good for venture capital.
Exactly.
But the technology of music recording was advancing quickly. Mm-hmm. Tim Draper introduced me to something that he was doing, and that changed my world. I thought if you could record to a hard disk, then you had an asset and you could change distribution, which, you know, I've maintained it as one of the themes of my investing strategy. How do you shift distribution? So I did a startup at one point. This is after touring. I did a startup that was backed by Tim Draper and then Draper Associates, as it was called. And we thought we could advance the technology and advance the services to the artists for that reason. So Tim and I worked together. He was on my board. We sold that business to BMG in 1997. And I was running a record label in 97, 98 with BMG, signed my first two artists. We were going to deliver recordings online for the first time. Tim called me up and said, I'm going to do a media focused fund in LA. Would you help me? And so I tripped and fell into venture capital. I did not look at it as a career opportunity. That's how I got here. And that's what got me into venture.
That's an amazing story. And what do you love most about VC and being an investor?
Oh, it's the newness every day. I get to meet incredible women and men who have come up with incredible ideas. I get to work with them. I provide a little fuel for their fire, and it's new every day. And I've always been a people person. Mm-hmm. So I enjoy connecting with people and then connecting those people to other people. Right. So it's the connections where I find that is my superpower as a VC. Everyone has their superpower. But for me, it's been about connecting entrepreneurs to other money, future customers, great new people and talent for their businesses.
Absolutely.
And it makes sense. Sometimes I joke with people that ask me, what skills do you need for your job? And I say 1/3 of it is psychology. 1/3 of it is business, 1/3 technology. But early on, you're really betting on people. So I'd be curious to hear how your people skills or things you learned with your prior career could be applied to this career.
Oh, that's interesting. I left Stanford a little bit high on myself because I had gone to Stanford. But I learned very quickly that the people in the music business, most of whom had very few entry qualifications, unquote, were actually just as smart as the next person. And in fact, many times smarter. And I met a lot of people who were way smarter than I was who were in the music business. And so I learned not to judge by background or pedigree. I learned to judge by actions and focus. So I ended up meeting a lot of entrepreneurs who maybe didn't have the pedigree, but had everything else you want in terms of unique advantage and unique drive.
And is there an example?
I met a young man who was a weapons officer in the military. And while, of course, you get a certain education being in the military, he was in fact in a submarine. He did not have the Harvard, Stanford pedigree that some people think is important. What I liked about him was he went to an unknown technical university to get his degree. And what I loved about him was he was breaking in, I probably shouldn't say this, he was breaking into the university buildings at night to get the Wi-Fi to do his startup. And I love that gritty moxie. I love how he got it off the ground. And the reason I bring him up is he has been through some tough moments as an entrepreneur, and he gritted it out. And he's got a great business today that's growing really well. And I'm lucky to be his investor and board member.
That's awesome. That's a great story.
And what qualities do you think make for a great VC?
I'm actually going to quote Don Valentine. For those of you who don't know who that is, he's a great early VC investor, a great innovator, back with Bill Draper and a few other of the first VCs on the West Coast. I think he was the seed money for Apple, actually.
Yeah, who passed away last year, right? Or this year, yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah. And his quote is, "The world of technology thrives best when individuals are left alone to be different, creative, and disobedient." And I think the best quality of a VC is one who knows how to enable these great women and men they've backed, but get out of the way. And sometimes that's difficult. Sometimes you don't get it the way you want. Sometimes they do things in an unorthodox manner. That's exactly what you want. That's why I often quote the book, The Hypomanic Edge, which talks about what sorts of people make great entrepreneurs.
And that's actually Tim Draper's style, which is you bet on the people, get out of the way, let them do what they do best. Then it's all about, does this guy have what it takes? And then you have other VCs that we've all worked with, who try to micromanage everything and get in. And that, I agree with you, that doesn't work very well.
It should only be deployed as a VC methodology when things are not going well. And not going well means we're not achieving any of the big goals we set up with a financing. Going well means we are achieving the goals, even though you may not like the way I'm getting there. Sorry, I don't have a pristine board package. I was busy closing $100 million worth of business.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about your fund Frontier, about the genesis of it and the strategy and focus.
It goes back to Tim Draper again, because I was working with Tim on a fund in LA doing media, and he called me up and asked me to leave that fund to help found Frontier with another gentleman named Scott Linette. And they had a commitment for some money, but they needed to pull together a team. And I think what I had was some history of having pulled a fund together in LA. So I made a good partner for Scott. We pulled together a $20 million fund with CalPERS. My strategy at Frontier has changed over the years, but this particular strategy was interesting. We were founded as a double bottom line fund, meaning not only were we supposed to make money, but we were supposed to find and fund companies in rural parts of California that were overlooked by the more mainstream venture community. And the second fund that we did at Frontier, we actually expanded that premise into expanded geography into the Pacific Northwest, mm-hmm. where we saw similar features of good educational institutions in the middle of nowhere. Therefore, if you just had the money, and there were also models for success in the Pacific Northwest, so you had all the primordial soup for startups. So the second fund did that. Then in the third fund, we had a strategy shift because we no longer had that double bottom line. We no longer had institutional investors that wanted that double bottom line and were investing out of special vehicles for that. And so I thought a lot about what was our advantage. And I realized that we'd built up a network over 15 years that was valuable. And so how do you leverage that network? And what we theorized was you could have a trusted network as your limited partner, meaning the people who provide your fund with the capital. And yet your LP could also be the trusted side-by-side investor or follow-on investor. For example, many of the LPs in our fund are other venture capitalists with much bigger funds. And that has worked really well because something like 75% of the deal flow comes from my VC and angel friends and LPs. And a lot of the follow-on also follows that strategy. So that's been the evolution over time of our focus. And we are no longer geographically imposed or confined. I'm a U.S. investor now. Frontier's got companies all over the U.S. And we really think about the world in terms of themes. And one of our main themes is around what we call real-time feedback, meaning that mobile and connectivity has created massive business shifts in what you can find in real time. Examples would be a heart monitor that tells a doctor something valuable in real time, or a radio device that could tell you in real time that a drone was coming, what's the threat level, and what could you do about the drone, or even enterprise software that tells you in real time that you're in or out of compliance when it comes to equitable pay for men, women, minorities, so that you're never out of compliance or in fact doing something ethically wrong.
And are all these examples companies that you actually backed?
Yes. And so people look at our website and go, boy, you're all over the place. You're a generalist investor. And I would say no. We can say no to a company so quickly because they don't take advantage of that shift. But we certainly could see why having anomalous heartbeat behavior in real time could tell a doctor, maybe we shouldn't do surgery tomorrow. Or telling someone that you should probably be careful about this drone. It's about to fly into the stadium around the Super Bowl. That would be bad. Or there are several companies that have actually been in horrible lawsuits because they have not been paying people equally for equal work.
Right. And what sort of trends are you seeing within those particular focus areas?
Well, in the real-time feedback, what we've noticed is it can work in IT, can work in enterprise software. It works in healthcare in a way that we have found very interesting. So the heart monitor is only one that we've done in the healthcare space. So I actually believe that it may be most interesting in the healthcare space, especially as healthcare and the way it's delivered and the expectations and how it's paid for all change in the coming years, months.
And I think it's interesting that originally you started geographically focused and now you're not. So I'd be curious about whether you think geography plays a role and whether you find great deals in places that you wouldn't expect. And Steve Case, for example, has pushed the whole agenda of finding great startups anywhere, right? And so, you know, even 20 years ago, people thought that the internet was actually going to change the dynamic. And I would argue a lot of it hasn't changed, right? Like most of the startups start in these big companies. But have you found great startups in smaller cities?
Let's take Silicon Valley as the elephant in the room. That's where a lot of money, most of the money, a gigantic majority of the money is focused.
Right.
And if you're Sequoia, or if you're Tim Draper, or if you're, you name the marquee funds in those areas, they have an advantage. They've been there forever. They have the networks. So if you are a small fund, as we have been over a series of several funds, where is the advantage? We started in Los Angeles. I expanded to New York a few years ago because these are cities that can support great startups, but don't have exactly the same attention as right. the Silicon Valley. I happen to live in Boulder, Colorado, and I have for the last year. I have found the same exact situation here with CU Boulder, a great tech community, lots of venture capital. The Foundry guys came here from Silicon Valley and set up a huge network, including Techstars. So,
everyone is, from what I hear.
So, and Texas too, right?
We'll where be there too. Just give us a month.
Yeah, we've got to build more housing. But the reason I'm saying all this is I think my advantage, my strategy has always been Silicon Valley is taken care of. I have to look very carefully for the same kind of entrepreneurship outside of Silicon Valley and find the capital for it and provide the capital for it. What we've been able to do is find them in New Jersey, find them in Boulder, find them in Austin, Texas, and then we build them. And then Silicon Valley can look and say, aha, there's a great company in New Jersey. Let's pile money on that one. We wouldn't have seen that, but thank God for David Kremen for finding that deal and showing it to us. We wouldn't have seen it otherwise.
I'm curious as to whether you have seen an exodus now from Silicon Valley. I hear more and more recently about VCs leaving, and that could be attributed to a couple of things. One is COVID, right? People figured out that they can do deals remotely. So I'm curious if you're seeing that, if you're seeing people consciously moving out.
I'm an example. I consciously moved out.
Conscious uncoupling is what it's called. Technical term.
Is that right?
No, I'm kidding.
I consciously uncoupled from California. I had been wanting to move out for a while for many reasons. Quality of life was tough in Los Angeles. The traffic is hard. I'm sure it's hard in the Silicon Valley as well. Housing prices are high. That's not to say that Boulder, Colorado is low overhead, but the quality of life in Boulder or Denver is different from Los Angeles and the Bay Area. And I think some people will move out for quality of life. I can also tell you that taxes are higher in places like New York and Los Angeles and San Francisco than they are in Boulder or Austin or Florida or Nevada. So there are reasons to move out. I don't think there's going to be a mass exodus. And in fact, I think young people are going to flock to New York and San Francisco because there will be some pricing adjustment as people may leave for whatever reasons, family reasons even. Sometimes you want your kids not in the big city. You want some dirt under their feet. So I don't think there's going to be a mass exodus, but I left for a reason and others will too. I think people will also flock and take their places.
Definitely. So I know you've written about this. So what do you think makes for a great pitch? And the flip side of the coin of that is, what are some of the biggest mistakes that you've seen a founder make when they pitch you?
When we started Frontier, we were in Sacramento and Santa Barbara so that we could look at the rural areas of California, but around the universities that were doing interesting technologies. And the reason I say that is one of the things we realized is we needed to bring culture and training to those universities, whereas Stanford has all of it. We needed to bring it to UC Davis, UC Santa Barbara, and Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo, which is the largest technical institute west of Texas Tech. So what we taught was, how do you even figure out if and tell somebody else that a business is feasible? And so what we taught was, how do you express that? And I think it's pretty easy to express your business. And we see mistakes made all the time, but I love to know in a nutshell what a company does. And it's usually a verb and a noun. We make and sell software that, and then you say what it is that you do that's different. Then I want to know, is that big? Could that be a big opportunity? Because if it's not, maybe you need angel investment or friends and family. Maybe it's not for venture capital, because venture capitalists are looking for something that could be very big, uncapped in its size. And we need the imagination to know how that could be. And then the final thing I like to know before the big one is, why will you win? What's your advantage? So what do you do? Why is it big? Why will you win? And usually part of the advantage has to do with the team. And that's the big one. You want to know what she's done for the last 10 years that made her rabidly need to do this. Why has he got the education or the technical chops? And then you asked about mistakes I've seen. I've seen people try and value the company. Most VCs shy away from that because the art of valuation, especially at the early stage, it's a little different at the later stage, but my world is early stage. There's an art to valuation. And so I think you should never value your company going into a meeting. And I also dislike long, involved PowerPoints where I'll ask a question and they'll say, we'll get to that sometime in 2022. And I also really like when someone can come with a PowerPoint. By the way, this applies to we capital funds as well. When I pitch, I go, here's who I am. Here's what we plan to do. Here's our advantages, our network. What do you want to know about our venture fund? Because you're smart. You know what you want to ask. I love it when someone isn't prepared to give me a long pitch. They're prepared to tell me the key points. Then what is it that you, the venture capitalist, who's probably got some reason for meeting with me, the entrepreneur, you probably know something, otherwise you wouldn't have met with me. So tell me what you need to know more of to know that this is unusual.
That's great advice.
What is the craziest pitch you've ever been through?
Wow. I actually funded one of the craziest pitches I ever heard.
Like, tell us.
There was a woman who theorized that you could turn breast milk into a superfood for micro premature infants. And everyone laughed at me for doing this deal. But I really believed, without scientific evidence, by the way, that breast milk was in fact better than formula. That company, Prolacta Bioscience, which I'm just going to say happens to be an investment now in the Proof Fund, that company now has proven scientifically that it prevents death. And now, like the blood business, they're beginning to solve problems with their superfood, but come up with a whole bunch of new products based on the features of the milk that are so valuable. So we're still really excited about this one. So that was a wacky pitch, but I liked Bulldozer Camp.
What is that?
Bulldozer Camp was, we're going to put a big piece of land in the middle of nowhere and big toys for big boys. You'd get to go and drive bulldozers around and kill yourself. We thought that was crazy, but funny, and maybe actually really a good idea.
That's funny.
And assets, would you have done that?
Why not? Big toys.
I would.
David, is there anything else that you would like us to cover specifically that maybe we didn't ask about?
Oh, the only thing I'd say, and I'm going back to what's a mistake again, because there's so many that can be made, but I have found a lot of entrepreneurs, and I've blogged about this, they don't get to the point of metrics and things that drive a business engine. They wave their arms and tell you how great it's going to be. And I tend to prefer articulation over gesticulation. And I think that's really important for entrepreneurs to realize that facts and support for a business engine are the only thing that matter to venture capitalists, because they're thinking maybe that's an engine we can pour hot fuel onto and make the engine go faster.
In your mind, what does the future of VC look like 5 to 10 years from now?
It's a pretty evolved business. I don't think there's going to be a whole bunch of changes. There's been a lot of new funds that have come in. What I've noted is a lot of them go away over time. They're not successful because, by the way, this business is really hard.
Right.
And so it ebbs and flows. The market ebbs and flows. The number of funds, which was interestingly high 2 years ago, is actually lower in 2020. There was about 400 funds that raised about $6 billion in 2018, which was a record. This year, same kind of number was raised, but only by 240 funds. So you're going to see some of the smaller funds go by the wayside. You'll see some new great names. Andreessen came out of nowhere, whatever it was, 8-10 years ago. Now it's a big name. So I think you'll see similar business, some new names and faces.
I think the biggest asymmetry and issue in venture, especially in early stage venture, is the length of time that it takes for a good startup to build and become a huge business. Because sometimes you get into your stride and then value appreciation happens so quickly once you figure things out. And sometimes that's in year 11 and 12, but LPs want out. They invest in 10-year funds. And the average fund, I think, out is now for 17 years or so. That's the average. Maybe the secondary market could allow some recaps and things like that. But that's a big issue, I think. Do you have an opinion on that?
I see exactly the same thing you just said. I have experienced some of that time delay. I've experienced some of it from the fact that there's much bigger private capital available than there was 10 years ago to keep a company private longer. I also know that government imposed regulations, good or bad, have caused higher costs for a public company, which is why people are staying private longer. So there's a lot of things that are driving this longer path, but venture capital is still a great asset class and still has outperformed many of the other asset classes. So I stand by it. I don't have the current 20-year numbers near me right now, but I think it's still outperforming.
Great. At this point, we're going to shift to our standard questions in an attempt to get to know better. So number one is, if you could have a magic wand and change or improve something about the VC industry, what would it be and why?
I think I would use the word empathy. I've noticed, I was an entrepreneur before I was a venture capitalist, and I remember going without paychecks. I remember having no cash. I remember the stress of it all. And I've been in boardrooms where I did not feel the empathy for the entrepreneur coming from the venture capital community. What are these people going through on a daily basis? What is the life that she is leading as a CEO or founder? What are the pressures and how can we help and how can we be sensitive to that? And I haven't seen enough empathy. And by the way, that's not just in the VC world. I see this in business broadly, but I think it could really apply to venture capital and to the entrepreneurs because it is one pressure-filled business. And I just hope that more people could understand what the life of an entrepreneur actually is like.
Number two, if you were not a VC investor and money was not a concern, what career would you have?
Jennifer, what do you think my answer is going to be?
I don't know. Would you go back to being a recording artist?
Oh, hells yeah.
Are we going to start a band?
Oh, hells yeah. Are you a singer? What's your instrument?
No, I would scare children. I cannot do that. I mess up the lyrics to literally every song.
I still play music. I still record and I still play live. And we've just done a 3-song, what used to be called an EP, but we're going to release it sometime after Christmas. And I'm still very excited. So that's what I would do if I were not a VC. But let me just tell you, I love being a VC. Despite how much I loved being in the record business, I have found my people in the entrepreneurs and venture capitalists that I'm lucky enough to interact with. So
that's awesome.
Number three, who is someone you look up to and why?
My answer is the Draper family, because when I think about it, Tim Draper got into business in 1990. So it's been 30 years together. Along the way, I collaborated very closely with his father, Bill Draper. And frankly, along the way, I've now collaborated with Tim's daughter, Jesse, and his 2 sons who have also done venture capital. And this is 4 generations of VCs. So when I think of why they're important to me, Bill Draper created the foundation on which I run a venture fund today with the GPLP relationship. Then he was smart and he did the first ever fund in India and he made exorbitant amounts of money for his investors. Then Tim saw the internet coming early and I think he really changed the business in the Silicon Valley, but then changed it more when he was, if not the first, I think he was one of the first innovators around creating a global venture capital network. Then he moves to Bitcoin. And while everyone's laughing and he's buying millions and millions of dollars of Bitcoin, I think today he's laughing and continues to be a great mentor to me and a great inspiration and helped me become a venture capitalist. Then he helped me start Frontier. And then he helped reinvent Frontier with me back in 2015. So a combination of successful instincts, proven outcomes, this family is unbelievable.
That's great. And finally, what is the best piece of advice you've ever received?
I'll never forget this. And I quote it all the time. I was in a deal with Bill Draper. And Bill is my partner, Tim's dad. And he wasn't going well. And I remember in the boardroom one day, he slammed his hand on the boardroom quite loudly and aggressively, I might add. And he said, "That's it. I'm done with this. I resign from the board. I'm out of here." He got up and he left and flew back to the Silicon Valley. And everyone in the boardroom was jaw dropped. And I remember thinking that there was a real business that we had with the company. And we went and validated that, as VCs should do. You always go out and get validation from the market that, will the customer buy this if you get it right? And we really believed it. And we thought, we have to fund this company. We have to keep the faith. But Bill had slammed his hand on the table and told us he would never do it. So I called him and I said, we want to fund this company and you're out. Do we recap this and get rid of former investors? Oh my God. He screamed at me in a good way. He said just as vehemently, David, friends don't do that to friends. Your job is to come convince your friend that there's still an opportunity here. Do not recap people and hurt people. Always come and use your best efforts to convince us and sell us. Now, obviously, there are times when hard things have to happen in business. So I'm sure he didn't mean never do the things you have to do. But the lesson I learned was we talked him into putting more money in. He did. And the company was a huge success. It is a huge success. And it's that friends don't do that to friends. You should not go around hurting people in your business actions. And that was the real lesson, because it has advised me on everything I've ever done. I try to include everyone in the decisions, in the actions. It doesn't always work, but I have found it works more often. And therefore, I have many fewer enemies, and I'm glad.
That's great advice.
David, thank you for taking the time today. This was a lot of fun. We're looking forward to continuing to work together. So thank you again.
Thanks for having me. This was really fun, and good luck with your ongoing series of the podcast.
And follow us on Twitter @ProofVC or on our website @proof.vc.